This is Audible.
Simon & Schuster Audio presents Storytelling, written and read by Tori Spelling.
Hi, I'm Tori Spelling. When you're a kid, you don't worry what anyone thinks. You go around saying whatever pops into your head or picking your teeth, and it never occurs to you that someone might think you're gross, awkward, or ridiculous. That was me, picking my nose, snorting when I laughed, wearing white after Labor Day. I just was who I was. That all changed one day at the tender age of 12 when I was getting ready for a family photo. We were having a formal family portrait taken with our dogs. Doesn't everyone do that? And I was getting frustrated with my bangs. I couldn't get them to do whatever a 12-year-old in 1985 wanted bangs to do. So I went into my parents' bathroom, all dressed up, with my hair done as best I could manage, and asked my mother, "Am I pretty?" She looked at me and said, "You will be when we get your nose done." I was stunned. My nose, as noses tend to be, was right in the middle of my face. And I had just been told that it was ugly. So long, innocence. To be fair, let the record show that my mother has absolutely no recollection of making this comment. I know this because in high school, I took a class called Human Development, taught by Mrs. Wildflower. In it, we had to keep a journal. Her name was Mrs. Wildflower. What did you expect? And when Mrs. Wildflower read my story about the nose incident, she called my parents. That afternoon, I came home to find my mother crying. She said, "I never said that. I'd never say something like that." I'm sure she was telling the truth, as she remembered it. Nonetheless, I had my nose done the minute I turned 16. Or didn't you hear? But what I realized as a 12-year-old was bigger than that I was destined for the plastic surgeon's chair. I realized that how other people saw me wasn't necessarily how I saw myself. Feeling pretty or smart or happy wasn't all there was to it. What I hadn't considered before was how I was perceived. And it wasn't the last criticism I'd hear about my nose. Little did I know then how huge a role public perception would play in my life. My nose and pretty much every other prominent body part and feature would be prey to gossip and tabloids in just a few years. But the unwanted attention wasn't limited to my body. According to the press, I was the rich, spoiled daughter of TV producer Aaron Spelling. They claimed I grew up in California's largest single-family residence. They said that my father had fake snow made on his Beverly Hills lawn for Christmas. They said I was the ultimate example of nepotism, a lousy actor who nonetheless scored a lead role in her father's hit TV show. They pigeonholed me as my character on Beverly Hills 90210, Donna Martin, the ditzy blonde virgin. They later talked about my wedding, my divorce, and my second wedding. They reported that I'd been disinherited and was feuding with my mother. They told about the birth of my son. What I learned from my ugly nose was true times a million. The details of my life were and would always be considered public property. Some of what you may have read about me is accurate. My father did hire a snow machine for Christmas. Some false. I didn't live in that enormous house until I was 17. And some exaggerated. I wasn't disinherited. But all the while, the life I was living was much more than that. I lived in fear of my own dog collection. I let a bad boyfriend spend my 90210 salary. I planned a fairy tale wedding to the wrong man. I begged casting directors to forget that Donna Martin ever existed. I was working hard and shopping like crazy. I was falling in love and getting hurt. My life has been funnier and sadder and richer and poorer than any of the magazines know. public opinion dies hard. To this day, I still look in the mirror and hate my nose. Still, everyone else has been telling stories about me for decades now. It's about time I told a few of my own. X marks the spot. Here's the part of my story where I'm supposed to say, sure, my family had lots of money, but I had a normal childhood just like everyone else. Yeah, I could say that, but I'd be lying. My childhood was really weird. Not better or worse than anyone else's childhood, but definitely different. Part of it was the whole holiday thing. My parents liked to make a spectacle, and the press ate it up. Like I said, it's true that my father got snow for our backyard one Christmas. But that's only half the story. If anyone's counting, he actually did it twice. The first time was when I was 5. My father told our family friend, Aunt Kay, that he wanted me to have a white Christmas. She did some research, made a few calls, and at 6 a.m. on Christmas Day, a truck from Barrington Ice in Brentwood pulled up to our house. My dad, Aunt Kay, and a security guard dragged garbage bags holding 8 tons of ice into the back, where there was plastic covering a 15-foot square patch of the yard. They spread the snow out over the plastic, Dad with a pipe hanging from his mouth. To complete the illusion, they added a styrofoam snowman that my father had ordered up from the props department at his studio. It was 80 degrees out, but they dressed me up in a ski jacket and hat and brought me out into the yard, exclaiming, "Oh, look, it snowed!" In all of Los Angeles, it snowed right here in your backyard. Aren't you a lucky girl? I'm sure that little white patch was as amazing to a 5-year-old as seeing a sandbox for the first time. But my parents didn't stop there. 5 years later, they were thinking bigger. And technology was too. This time, again with Aunt Kay's guidance, my dad hired a snow machine to blow out so much powder that it not only filled the tennis court, it created a sledding hill at one end of the court. I was 10, and my brother Randy was 5. They dressed us in full-on snowsuits. The outfits were for the photos, of course. It was a typical 85 degrees out. According to Aunt Kay, the sledding hill lasted 3 days, and everyone came to see the snow in Beverly Hills. Robert Wagner, Mel Brooks, not that I noticed or cared. Randy and I spent Christmas running up the hill and zooming down in red plastic saucer sleds. Even our dogs got to slide down the hill. It was a pretty spectacular day for an LA girl. My parents didn't get the concept of having me grow up like other kids. When I was about 8, my class took a field trip to my dad's studio. It was a fun day. My father showed us around and had some surprises planned, such as a stuntman breaking glass over some kid's head. But then, at the end of the day, the whole class stood for a photo. My father and I were in the back row, and just before the shutter clicked, he picked me up and held me high above the class. My face in the photo says it all. I was beyond embarrassed that my dad was lifting me up like that. I just wanted to fit in. When I complained to him, he said, "But you couldn't be seen." He just didn't get it. And then there were the birthday parties. The setting was always the backyard of our house on the corner of Mapleton and Sunset Boulevard in Holmby Hills, a fancy area on the west side of Los Angeles. It was a very large house, though not the gigantic manor where everyone thinks I grew up. Maybe 10,000 square feet. It was designed by the noted LA architect Paul Williams, whose many public buildings include the famous Beverly Hills Hotel. A house he designed in Bel Air was used for the exterior scenes of the Colby Mansion on my dad's television series, The Colbys. Our house's back lawn was probably an acre surrounded by landscaping, with a pool and a tennis court, the regular features of houses in that neighborhood. As I remember it, the theme for my birthdays was always Raggedy Ann, and there would be a doll centerpiece and rented tables and chairs with matching tablecloths, napkins, and cups. But every party had some new thrill. There were carnival moon bounces, which weren't common then as they are today, and fare booths lined up on both sides of the lawn offering games of ring toss, balloon darts, duck floats, whack-a-mole, and the like. One birthday had a dancing poodle show conducted by a man in a circus ringleader's outfit. Another included a puppet show with life-size puppets. And one year we had a surprise visit from Smidget, who at the time was the smallest living horse. My godfather, Dean Martin, whom I called Uncle Bean, always brought me a money tree. A little tree with rolled up $20 bills instead of leaves. Just what a girl like me needed. When my sixth grade class graduated, we had a party at my house for which my father hired the USC marching band. Apparently, my dad first approached UCLA, but they said no. According to Aunt Kay, who organized a lot of these parties for my parents, my father told her, "Money is no object." Well, it must have been an object to the USC marching band because all 100-plus members showed up to play Pomp and Circumstance and whatever else marching bands come up with to play at sixth grade graduations. I have to admit, I didn't even remember the marching band's presence until Aunt Kay told me about it. What I remember are the things a 12-year-old remembers. The rented dance floor and the DJ and hoping that the boy I liked would ask me to slow dance to Crazy for You by Madonna. I remember swimming in the pool. I remember feeling really sad that we were all moving on to different schools. I remember being only mildly embarrassed that my mother was hula hooping on the dance floor, but I'm sure I was truly embarrassed by the marching band. My parents were endlessly generous, and those parties were spectacular on paper. The reality was a little more complicated. For every birthday and Christmas, my big present was always a Madame Alexander doll. Madame Alexander dolls are classic collectible dolls, sort of like a rich man's Barbie. But, at least in my house, they were meant for display, not play. My mother loved the best of the best, for herself and for me. She was known for her dynasty-style jewelry, quarter-size emeralds dangling off nickel-sized diamonds. Most attention-grabbing was the 44-carat diamond ring she always wore. That's right, you heard right. 44 carats. Walking around with that thing must have been as good as weightlifting. I always begged her not to wear the ring to school functions, but that was her everyday style. Put together in blouses with Chanel belts, slim jeans, Chanel flats, perfectly manicured red nails, and a heavy load of jewelry worth millions of dollars. As for the Madame Alexander dolls, every birthday, as soon as I unwrapped them, they were whisked away, tags still attached, to a special display case in my room that had a spotlight for each doll. No way in hell was I allowed to dress and undress them, or, God forbid, cut their hair. Every time I unwrapped a present, my heart sank a little bit when I saw that same powder blue box. I knew that all I had was a new, untouchable doll to add to my expensive collection. But my mother would be smiling with pleasure. She loved the dolls, had always coveted them as a girl, and wanted me to have something special. I didn't want to hurt her feelings, so I always thanked her and acted really excited. She had no idea that all I wanted, at some point, was a Barbie dream house. So now, imagine another birthday party. I was 4 or 5. The great lawn was festooned with balloons and streamers. Colorful booths lined the perimeters of its downward slope, and in the center of it all was a mysterious white sheet with a big red X painted across it. In the middle of the festivities, a plane flew overhead. I was just starting to read, but our family friend, Aunt Kay, had spent all morning teaching me how to read "Happy Birthday, Tori." Not coincidentally, the plane was pulling a banner saying just that. I read it, and I was thrilled and proud, jumping up and down and clapping my hands in excitement. Aunt Kay waved to the pilot, and he dropped a little parachute with a mystery gift attached to its strings. So dramatic. It was supposed to hit the X on the sheet, but instead, it landed in a tree. One of the carnival workers had to climb the tree to get it down. I later found out that Aunt Kay had to get special permits for the plane to fly that low over the house. As soon as my present was liberated, I ran to the box and pulled away the padding until I got to the present. I tore open the wrapping paper, and there it was, the powder blue box. Another Madame Alexander doll. This one was a surprise, along with the plane from Aunt Kay. Some of my most valuable dolls were gifts from her collection. My friends all oohed and awed, and I fake squealed with joy. Then I handed the doll over to my mother so her dress wouldn't get dirty. At some point, I wondered if all these spectacular events were actually being done for me. I mean, really. How many sixth grade girls' biggest fantasy is for a college marching band to play at their graduation? Take Halloween. When I was 5 or 6, my mother decided I would go as a bride. No polyester drugstore costume for me, no sir. Halloween found me wearing a custom bridal gown made by the noted fashion designer Nolan Miller, with padded boobs and false eyelashes. And like many Halloweens, I wore high heels. It wasn't easy to find heels for a young child, so my mother went through the Yellow Pages until she found a little person store that sold grown-up shoes in my size. Then there was the Marie Antoinette costume my mother had Nolan Miller make for me when I was 9 or 10. My 5-year-old brother Randy was Louis XIV, a costume that actually suited him, even at that young age. He was already showing a taste for the finer things. We'd go to a restaurant, he'd tell the waiter, "For my appetizer, I'll have the escargot." My Marie Antoinette costume had golden brocade, a bone bodice, and gigantic hip bustles. It was topped off with an enormous powdered wig of ringlets so heavy that I got my first headache. I looked like one of those Madame Alexander dolls of which my mother was so fond. Meanwhile, Randy got off easy in a ruffled coat and a comparatively lightweight wig. My parents drove their young royals to the flats of Beverly Hills, LA's prime trick-or-treating turf. The houses were closer together than those in our neighborhood, but still inhabited by rich people who didn't think twice about giving out full-size candy bars. Not that we got to keep any of the candy we collected anyway. My mother was paranoid about hidden razor blades and poisoned chocolate, so she always confiscated our booty and replaced it with bags that she'd painstakingly assembled herself. As I wobbled my way down the street trying to adjust my new center of gravity, some kids threw raw eggs at me. I barely felt the first couple. They must have hit my bustle. But then, as if in slow motion, I saw two eggs coming toward us, one at me, one at my brother. Randy darted out of the line of fire, but I couldn't escape because of my enormous petticoats. An egg hit me in the ear. I wish I could at least claim it was some French immigrants avenging their 18th century proletariat ancestors, but I think I was just caught in run-of-the-mill vampire Jedi knight crossfire. After the Marie Antoinette debacle, I'd had it. When Halloween rolled around again, I begged to be anything other than a historical figure. I wanted to be a plain old bunny. You know, the classic Halloween costume. Plastic mask, grocery bag for candy, jacket hiding the one-piece paper outfit. My mother agreed to the bunny concept. But instead of drawn-on whiskers and bunny ears on a headband, I had a hand-sewn bunny costume, which had me in fake fur from head to toe, with just my face showing. Who was I to complain? It was the best bunny costume a girl could ever want. Unfortunately, after 4 houses, I had an allergy attack and had to go home. For all the effort and fanfare my parents put into my childhood, I'm most sentimental about some of the lower-key indulgences, the ones that had nothing to do with how I was dressed or what kind of party our family could throw. We have a beach house in Malibu, and whenever we went there, my mother and I would walk out to the end of our beach to pick shells. This is the same beach house where Dean Martin, my Uncle Bean, came to stay for a summer during his divorce. He was a huge golfer and traveled with a stockpile of golf balls that had his autograph printed on them. Every morning, he'd set up a driving range on the private beach in front of our house and shoot golf balls into the ocean. People from all sides of the beach would be diving into the water to collect these golf balls as souvenirs. But Uncle Bean would just keep hitting the balls, completely oblivious. Anyway, whenever my mother and I went shelling, she always brought her purse, which wasn't suspicious since she smoked at the time. I'd hunt for shells and she'd urge me on, pointing me to spots I'd missed. It never took me long to find a few big, beautiful, polished seashells. I was always telling my friends that Malibu had the most amazing seashells. My Malibu illusions were shattered when I was 12. We took a family trip to Europe, but because my father refused to fly, we took the scenic route. It started with a 3-day train trip to New York in a private train car attached to the back of a regular Amtrak train. We brought 2 nannies, my mother's assistant, and 2 security guards. From New York, we took the Queen Elizabeth II to Europe. I loved the boat. It had a shopping mall, restaurants, and a movie theater. But what excited me most was that they had little arts and crafts activities scheduled for the kids. It was the closest to summer camp I ever got. It was also the farthest from home I ever got. Every other family vacation was spent in Vegas, mostly because we could get there by car. In England, we made the tourist rounds. Trafalgar Square, Madame Tussauds, and so on. Of course, when my mother saw the crown jewels at the Tower of London, she commented, "I have a necklace bigger than that." It was true. She did. But I was talking about the breaking of the Malibu seashell mythology. In England, I was reading OK or Hello, one of those gossip magazines that were more respectable back in the 80s, and I came across an interview with my parents. In it, my mother talks about how she used to buy exotic seashells and hide them for me on the beach in Malibu. Total shock to me. So much for the beautiful seashells of Malibu. You know your family doesn't exactly communicate well when you find out things like this in weekly magazines. Part of why I was upset about the seashells, beyond normal, almost teenage angst, was that it had only been a year before that that I realized there is no Santa Claus or Easter Bunny. All I knew was that every year on the night before Easter, the Easter Bunny would call me on the phone and tell me to be a good girl. And every Christmas Eve, the phone would ring, and Santa's workers would inform my father that Santa had landed and he was approaching our house. A few moments later, there'd be a knock at the door, and there was Santa. My brother and I would rush to greet him in our coordinated Christmas outfits. I'd be wearing a red overall dress with a white shirt and red knee socks, and Randy would be wearing red overall shorts with a white shirt and red knee socks. We'd sit on Santa's lap, one on each knee, and tell him what we wanted for Christmas. Then he'd tell us to get to bed early, that tomorrow was a big day, and he'd ho, ho, ho out the door. It didn't always go so smoothly, like the time that Randy peed on Santa's knee. But for the most part, that was what had gone on for years, and I saw no reason to believe the kids at school when they said Santa was bunk. I saw him with my own eyes. I probably would have kept believing if my cousin Meredith hadn't come over for a sleepover when I was 11. She was a year older than I was, and that fact alone made her really cool. I was really psyched that she was spending the night. It was Easter, and I must have said something about the Easter Bunny's imminent arrival because she was like, "You're kidding that you think there's an Easter Bunny." And I said, "Yes, there is." Then she said, "Don't tell me you believe in Santa, too." The kids at school were 11 like I was. What did they know? Why should I believe them? But Meredith was 12. She knew stuff. I had to concede. If it hadn't been for her, who knows how long the charade might have gone on. Oh, and after that, I never saw Meredith again. I think her disclosures convinced my parents that she was a bad influence. As a kid, I felt deceived to discover my parents had been lying, but now I realize it was pretty lovely. My mother loved decorating for and with us, coloring Easter eggs, carving jack-o'-lanterns, setting up moving Santa scenes at Christmas time. The seashells, the holiday characters, the decorations, these were pure, sweet moments that weren't about putting on a show. They were about making us happy. These were the heartfelt private gifts from my parents for which I never knew to thank them. Looking back, what I remember with the most affection is being 4 years old and having a dad who would sit in the jacuzzi with me and make up stories. My father was a slight man with slouchy shoulders that made him appear even smaller. For all his power in Hollywood, most of the time he'd appear in a jogging suit with a pipe. He spoke in a soft voice with a hint of Texas twang and would come right up to you and shake your hand or give you a hug, even if he didn't know you well. The overall effect was very Wizard of Oz, man behind the curtain. This unimposing, gentle guy is the famous Aaron Spelling. People always felt comfortable with him right away. He and I would sit in the hot tub, and he'd be Hansel, and I'd be Gretel, and my mom, upstairs with a migraine, would be the witch. Yes, I now think this is weird, if not psychologically damaging, that my father let me cast my unwitting mother as the villain. At least I can say that on the day I have in mind, I kept looking up at the window of my mother's bedroom, hoping to see the shade go up, which meant that the witch felt better and might join us in the pool. Or we'd play Chasen's. Chasen's restaurant, which is now closed, was a legendary celebrity hangout on Beverly Boulevard in Beverly Hills. Frank Sinatra, Alfred Hitchcock, Marilyn Monroe, Jimmy Stewart, and most of the Hollywood elite were regulars in their day. When I was a kid, the family would go to Chasen's on Mother's Day or Father's Day for a fancy celebration. So my dad and I would recline in the jacuzzi and say, "We've just arrived at Chasen's. What should we order?" A few years later, I asked my parents for an allowance because the other kids at school had allowances. My father wanted to give me $5, but I wanted only 25 cents because that's what the other kids got. Dad told me that in order to earn my allowance, I'd have to help out around the house. So he gave me a job and said he'd do it with me. Every weekend, we go out into the yard to scoop up dog poo and rake leaves. That's right. Every weekend, TV mogul Aaron Spelling, net worth equivalent to some small island nation, went out and scooped poo with his daughter. We hadn't yet moved to the manor, that enormous house that the press can't get over, but we still had a large yard and four dogs. And of course, we had gardeners who were supposed to be taking care of all that. But there was always plenty for us to pick up, and I suspect that he told the gardeners to leave it be. Sort of like the seashells, I guess, but a lot grosser. No matter, I loved it. I remember spending a lot of time out on that lawn, hanging out with my dad, playing softball, or working in the vegetable garden with him and my mother. One year we grew a zucchini that was as big as a baby. There are photos of me cradling it. My father was very proud. No matter what it was, our family liked the biggest and the best. For the most part, my father thought that money was the way to show love. Where do you think all those lavish jewels my mother wore came from? Every holiday, he bought her a bigger and brighter bauble as if to prove his love. When I asked Aunt Kay to help me remember some of the extravagances, she said, money was no object. That's how much he loved you. There was no limit to what he would do for you. When my mom and I were planning my wedding, my father said almost the same thing. She loves you so much. Do you know how much she's paying for this wedding? That's how much she loves you. When it comes down to it, luxury wasn't the substance of my childhood. Love was simply the time my parents gave me. What I wish my father had understood before he died is that all of those large-scale memories he and my mother spent so much money and energy creating, picking up poo is what has stayed with me my whole life. How to sell lemonade. Unlike most kids my age, I never went away for summers. Not only did my father refuse to fly, he wouldn't allow me to go to summer camp. My father was pretty overprotective. I remember crying to my friends about not ever getting to sleep over. And this was when I was a senior in high school and already owned my first car. My father said he forbade summer camp because he'd miss me too much. But he worked such long hours. Maybe he was afraid I'd be kidnapped from camp and held for ransom. Who knows? I never questioned decisions like that in our house. My parents made the rules, and I respected them. So no August evenings spent around a campfire roasting marshmallows and telling ghost stories. Instead, I spent plenty of summer days in my father's office on the 20th Century Fox lot. My dad was a big shot in TV. By the time I was 6 or 7, he created Starsky and Hutch, Charlie's Angels, Fantasy Island, Vegas, Heart to Heart, and others, and commanded respect on the studio lot where his production company, then Spelling Goldberg Productions, had a mini compound of bungalows out of which they worked. It was like a little town to me. All the bungalows were like little houses, and there were very few cars on the streets. One of my father's assistants would keep an eye on me while he was busy inventing hit shows. Sometimes Dad's driver would zoom me around the lot in a golf cart or let me take a turn at the wheel. One day, I decided to set up a lemonade stand on the lot. I put out Minute Maid lemonade and started selling it, along with some little watercolors I'd done on tracing paper. They weren't prodigy art, just finger-paint-level doodles. It was a hot day, and I was doing some good lemonade business. And I must say I was pretty proud of my operation. Then a guy came up and said, "That's a great painting. I'm going to buy that." I knew it was just kid art and I was kind of embarrassed, so I said, "You don't have to." He paused, seemed to glance around quickly, then said, "Yes, yes I do." So I knew. I knew early on that I was Aaron Spelling's daughter, and that fact made the people around me act differently. Because of that, I guess all I wanted was to be normal. Isn't that the way it always goes? Plenty of children spend their days wishing they were rich. And what do rich kids do? Wish they were normal. I guess we all glamorize whatever it is that we aren't. But I know that rich kids can't go around asking for sympathy. One thing I had going for me was nanny. I had a nanny for all of my childhood and beyond. But to call her a nanny doesn't seem close to doing her justice. For years, I thought her name was actually Nanny. I had no idea to be a nanny was a job. I thought that there was this woman in our family named Nanny, a confidant and guide and angel with whom I spent all my time. In the photos of my parents carrying me home from the hospital, my mother is pushing the pram and my father and Nanny are on either side of her. And that's the way it was. Except that in later pictures, Nanny is often the one who was holding me. Nanny, whose real name was Margaret, was like a mother to me. If we're all a mix of nature and nurture, my parents gave me my nature, and Nanny was the nurture. Everything I learned from her. She was an African-American woman in her 50s, heavy-set, with tightly curled hair she had set every week. She was always impeccably dressed in a white uniform, and nobody messed with Nanny, not even my parents. But she had a beautiful, warm smile and an easy laugh. Nanny was like a family member and lived with us 5 days a week. And she stayed on with my parents when my brother and I moved out, until I was 27 years old. Even after she moved out, Nanny was still at every family dinner, every holiday celebration, every Mother's Day. She was a permanent part of our family. Nanny and I were so close. I'm sure at times it was tough on my mother. In third grade, I wasn't doing well in math. It came to a head on one of Nanny's days off. I refused to go to school, claiming I was sick. I must not have been a good actress. Who, me? Because my mother saw that I was faking. She sat me down to talk it through, and it finally came out that I never wanted to go to school again because I was afraid of my math teacher. My mother was very understanding, trying to calm me down and telling me that we'd hire a tutor. But I got more and more worked up. All I could say through my tears was, "I want Nanny. I want Nanny." Finally, my mother called Nanny at home and put me on the phone with her. Even though it was her day off, Nanny came over. That was all I needed. Nanny's presence calmed me down. The anxiety about math had transformed. The real issue became needing my nanny, and when she appeared, I knew that everything would be okay. The three of us went out to dinner at Dolores's, my favorite hamburger joint. My mother couldn't have been thrilled. She'd done everything that she could to help, and calling the off-duty nanny can't be a mother's best moment. I can still picture what her face looked like, chin up but not happy. Even as a child, I noticed her consternation, but only later did I understand what it meant. I sometimes think this was a turning point for the relationship between my mother and Nanny. I was closer to a woman she had hired than I was to her. It was a dynamic that she created and financed. From then on, my mother seemed to see Nanny as something of a threat. They had an up-and-down relationship. My dad didn't help matters by putting his arm around Nanny and saying, "I have two wives," and then winking and saying, "We all know who the real wife is." But ultimately, I'm grateful to my mother for doing what was best for me. She called Nanny that day. She kept Nanny on for my entire childhood and beyond. She let the relationship exist and flourish. When people ask me what it would have been like to grow up without money, what comes to mind is that I wouldn't have had Nanny. And if that were the case, I'd be a completely different person. As far as I'm concerned, my time with Nanny was the real world. It kept me grounded. Lots of my childhood memories are with Nanny, and most of them don't match anyone's idea of how Aaron Spelling's daughter spent her youth. Nanny lived in Crenshaw, a mostly middle-class African-American district in South L.A. On weekends when I was young, Nanny would load me, then later me and Randy, into the station wagon, the family house car, and take me to her world. In Crenshaw, we'd hang out with her friends and family. I remember spending hot afternoons sitting out on a small square of lawn in Crenshaw, running back and forth through the sprinklers with playmates while Nanny chatted with her friends. A familiar jingle would sound and the ice cream truck would come around the corner. I'd run over to buy a push-up, the only white kid as far as the eye could see. I loved going to Crenshaw with Nanny. I liked the small lawn and how all of Nanny's neighbors seemed to know each other. I liked being surrounded by other kids my age, playing whatever games occurred to us. I liked feeling like just another American kid. It made me feel completely safe. I don't know if my overprotective parents knew where we went with Nanny, but I have a feeling that they wouldn't have considered Crenshaw as safe for me as I did. Like I said, I was stuck at home all summer. The most happening thing in my neck of the woods was the housekeepers going about their daily activities. All I wanted was to be a part of it. so I'd ask if I could work with them. They'd scrub floors, I'd scrub floors. They'd fold laundry, I'd fold laundry. When they broke for lunch, I'd eat what they ate, when they ate, where they ate. It was the closest to normal that I could find. At some point during the summer I was 7, I informed my mother that I was moving. She gamely asked where it was that I planned to go. It was the laundry room cupboard. I liked the idea of settling into someplace relatively small and warm. So I brought my bedding, my portable TV, and a stock of provisions, including a can of corn. I had no can opener, but a can of corn was somehow critical to survival. Into the laundry room and took up residence. I lasted until bedtime. Actually, it wasn't just my desire to be like everyone else that made me move to a smaller, less decorated, cozy room. The truth is that I didn't exactly feel safe in my own room. See, all those gorgeous Madame Alexander dolls, collector's items, don't forget, were lined up in cases along the wall facing my bed. Can you imagine how scary it was for a 7-year-old girl to see all those eyes staring down at you in the darkness? Couple that with the fact that my mother loved horror films and screened them for company. There I was, 4 years old, sitting on my mother's lap in a big comfy chair watching Invasion of the Body Snatchers starring Donald Sutherland. I never slept soundly again. Eventually, terror drove me into Nanny's room, where I slept in a twin bed next to hers until I was 13. That's right, Nanny and I were roommates. I slept with Nanny when I was scared, cleaned the house with the maids on summer vacation, and dreamed of relocating to the laundry closet. But I guess the ultimate story about how closely I identified with the household employees is the story of my first off-screen kiss. When I was 15 years old, we had a young chef who was a total surfer dude. Dark blonde, flippy California hair, deep tan, a puka shell necklace, the works. At our house, he wore a chef outfit, clogs and palazzo pants. But when he left, he headed to the beach in an OP shirt, board shorts, and flip-flops. He was always flirting with me, and I ate it up. What 15-year-old wouldn't have a crush on the 26-year-old family chef surfer boy? My girlfriends and I would parade around the kitchen trying to get his attention. Then we'd retreat to my bedroom and talk about what he had said and what I had said back and how well I had flirted and how clearly it meant he was completely into me. And every morning I'd come into school and report on each detail of our interactions. When he put my sautéed halibut in front of me, our pinkies practically touched. He totally did it on purpose. Then, on New Year's Eve, I took the bull by the horns, so to speak. As we usually did on New Year's, my parents, Nanny, my brother, and I were gathered in the family room. The TV was on, and we had noisemakers, hats, and Japanese confetti balls. I had a friend over, and I was dressed up in a satiny blouse with shoulder pads and a skinny double-looped belt around it. The 80s. My parents drank champagne, and there was Martinelli's sparkling cider for the kids. I'd stolen a few sips of champagne, and armed with liquid courage, I commanded my friend, "Stand guard, I'm going back there." I snuck back to the kitchen. He led me to the laundry room. See, I knew my affection for that room was well-founded, and kissed me up against the dryer. It was amazing. It was huge. It would soon be the talk of the high school. I'd never had a boyfriend, and now a 26-year-old, an adult, was putting the moves on me. How cool was that? This went on for a couple of months. We snuck kisses, and he hid little love notes in my school papers. After a school dance, he came to drive me home, and we made out in his red pickup truck. Sigh. But my heart was soon to be broken. During recess one day, he pulled up to the side of the school. I jumped into his truck, and we kissed for 15 minutes. How cool was I? Then I went back to math class and passed notes with all the girls reporting what had happened. One of the kids told her mother, she called my mom, and the shit hit the fan. I came home from school that day and saw that his pile of cookbooks was gone from the kitchen. I knew what that meant, and I started to cry. Nanny comforted me, but then she said, "Your parents are in their bedroom, and they want to talk to you." They were furious. I can't understand why. Just because their 15-year-old daughter was involved with a man 11 years her senior? I was grounded for 5 months, a lifetime. although in retrospect, that was probably just to make sure I didn't see him again. I later found out that my mother had us both followed for months. After my punishment was meted out, my mother pulled me into her bathroom, saying she wanted to talk to me alone. She sat me on her chaise and stood above me, arms crossed. I started to tell her that I was in love with him, that she'd ruined my life by sending him away, and that I wanted to die. You know, the usual teen heartbreak drill. But she broke in and said firmly, "I need you to tell me right now, was there penetration?" Ew! She used the word penetration. Who says that? I was so grossed out, I almost vomited. No, Mom. I never saw the chef again. Actually, I did run into him once in my 20s outside a bar. He was kind of like, "Hey, wink, wink, you're all grown up." And I was thinking, "Boy, you're short." In my memory, he was so tall. But now, not so much. And all that surfing sun had taken its toll. But it was still a perfect first kiss. And to this day, my mom is only half joking when she says, "He was the best chef we ever had. Too bad you had to ruin it." Nepotism works both ways. I'm getting ahead of myself. So let's go back a few years. I was shy. I didn't want to stand out, to make a fuss, to be different. Except when it came to one thing, acting. People always think I became an actress because I could. Like my choice of career was just another present that my father had a plane drop in the middle of the lawn for me. Yes, my dad did give me parts and acting lessons. And yes, my name opened doors for me. I'll get to all of that. But wanting to act is different from having the opportunity to act. And for me, wanting it started when I was only 5. It wasn't my dad who got me my first break. It was my mother's hairdresser. Jose Hebert had long, flowing blonde hair and always wore a different cowboy hat to hide his bald spot. Jose has been a big shot stylist to the stars for decades. At the time, he was styling people like Farrah Fawcett, Cher, and Elizabeth Taylor. So Jose was making an appearance on a talk show called Our Magazine, which was hosted by Gary Collins. They were doing a segment on styling celebrity children. Jose asked if I was willing to go on the show, and I agreed. I was really excited to be on TV. It was going to be me and Chastity Bono, who was much, much more sophisticated since she was all of 9 years old. On the day of the show, my mother brought me to the studio. As soon as we arrived, they led us around the side of the stage to show me where I would be entering. When I looked out, I saw that there was a studio audience. For some reason, I hadn't realized that there would be an audience. I freaked out and started saying I couldn't go out there in front of all those people. My mother, who never would be a pushy stage mother, told me I didn't have to do it. I could try it if I wanted, but it was okay if I wanted to back out. My hair was expertly styled, half up, with curls and bangs that started prematurely at the crown of my head. I was wearing a fancy dress from Bonwit Teller. I'd promised Jose I'd do it, and scared though I might be, I felt obligated. I walked out on stage and gave the audience a wave and a smile. They applauded. That was encouraging, so I gave a little curtsy. Now, this may or may not be true, but the way I remember it was that when I curtsied, the audience went wild with applause. It was my little Sally Field Oscar moment, thinking, they like me. Right now, they really like me. I'd always said that I wanted to be a veterinarian when I grew up, or failing that, a manicurist. But that night, I went home and I told my dad I wanted to be an actress. Here's where the nepotism comes in. That summer, my father promised he'd put me in one of his shows. As I mentioned, Vegas was pretty much our go-to vacation spot since you could drive there. Dad would rent a mobile home, and one of the drivers would transport us there while we watched movies in the back. For 3 weeks or so, we'd stay in the penthouse of the Desert Inn, where my dad's show Vegas was filmed. In those days, Vegas wasn't as family-friendly as it is now, but Randy and I loved running around the big hotel, hanging out at the pools, seeing movies during the day, and going to the arcade room. My mother always tried to find stuff for us to do, like visiting ghost towns or water parks. One time she arranged for us to go to a place called the Chicken Ranch. She thought we could see chicks hatching and feed the chickens. Dad had to explain to her that a chicken ranch was a whorehouse. She didn't believe him, so she called to check. The woman who answered the phone identified herself as Bubbles. When my mother asked if it was a kid-friendly place, Bubbles just started laughing. Anyway, the summer after my onstage debut, my father wrote a small part in Vegas for me. I even had a line. I got to say, "Hi, Uncle Dan," to Robert Urich, who played Dan Tana. Clearly, a critical role that was central to the entire episode. On the day we shot my episode, my father came to the set. He stood behind the camera all proud. I said, "Hi, Uncle Dan." The director said, "Cut." That was it. I was done. The director turned to me and said, "That's your new nickname, One Take Tori." I was all impressed with myself. After that, my dad put me in all his shows. During the school year, I'd always be gone for a week here and there doing small parts on Fantasy Island. "Hi, Uncle Rourke." "TJ Hooker." "Hi, Uncle TJ." "Love Boat." "Hi, Uncle Isaac." And the others. Just kidding about the actual lines. The truth is that the first time I was on Fantasy Island, I had one line with Tattoo. But by the time I made my second appearance, I had refined my craft. I was one of the guests who came down the walkway out of the plane. My storyline was that my parents had been killed in a car crash and that I came to Fantasy Island to find God. George Kennedy played a drunk who claimed to be God. I was in the big leagues. My father used to go over scenes with me before I went to an audition or shot a part. He'd give me direction, and after I did a scene, I'd look up for his reaction. When he thought I had nailed it, he'd say, "That was pluperfect," which he explained meant more than perfect. He never stopped saying that to me. Even after my high school plays, he'd say, "That was pluperfect." From the time I was really little, younger than 10, I prided myself on being very professional. I'd show up on time, report to hair and makeup, and sit without fidgeting as they prepared me for shooting. For better or worse, I always knew my lines and everyone else's. If an actor called out for his line, I'd tell it to him. I had no idea it was annoying. One time on TJ Hooker, William Shatner and I were doing a walk and talk scene. I played a gypsy girl who had witnessed her uncle being killed by the gypsy mob. We were walking out of the police station and he was asking me questions. It was a pretty intense scene. Now, the tough thing about walk and talk scenes is that if you forget a line, you have to start over from the very beginning. Shatner was forgetting his lines a lot, so I was helpfully reciting them to him. Finally, he hissed, "That is not nice to do. You shouldn't tell an actor a line. That's why there's a script supervisor." My feelings were hurt. I was barely 10 years old. But I also suspected that he just felt bad because he couldn't remember his lines. For decades, I thought William Shatner was an asshole because of that moment. Then I worked with him on a movie called A Carol Christmas for the Hallmark Channel. It was a remake of A Christmas Carol, where I played a modern-day Scrooge and Shatner played the ghost of Christmas Present. It was a reversal from our TJ Hooker moment, since now I was starring and he was a supporting character. He was incredibly nice and funny, and very professional. When an actor does a scene, the places where he's supposed to stand are marked with tape. I remember that he hit every single mark perfectly without ever looking down. Anyway, I couldn't believe that I'd relied on my 10-year-old self's first impression for so long. Of course, I didn't tell him how he traumatized me. I knew he wouldn't remember. I'm pretty sure he was too distracted by the lovely and then svelte Delta Burke, who was guest starring as my gypsy sister in the episode. So yes, it helped to have a father in the business. A lot. Some kids get summer jobs in their parents' offices or businesses. Me? I got bit parts in primetime soaps. But even then, being Aaron Spelling's daughter wasn't always the ticket to success. At my elementary school, the third grade play was Hansel and Gretel. The entire class auditioned by reading the play out loud. When the cast list went up, I discovered that I had won the coveted role of Gretel. The previous year, I played Becky and Tom Sawyer. So I had gotten the lead part 2 years in a row. That had to mean something. This acting was my special gift. It quickly emerged that the other children's parents were outraged that I'd gotten Gretel. They thought it was due to a conspiracy that I was given a lead role 2 years in a row. It had to have something to do with my father. Either he'd given money or the school wanted him to give money. I knew that I had won the role fair and square. But the parents made enough of a stink that the school just gave up. Did they replace me in the lead role? Nope. They simply canceled the play. Every other grade did a play, but ours was canceled. I was shattered. The irony was that while everyone thought my family was inflating my success, in fact, it was hindering me. Little did I know it then, but this pattern would show up over and over again in my life. I achieve something, people think it's all because of my father, and ultimately, I come away with nothing. Back at square one. Around this time, I started coming out of my shell a bit. I began to realize that I could make my friends laugh by being funny and acting kind of nutty. I graduated to Westlake, a private all-girls school in 7th grade. I started telling jokes and acting out stories, and the other kids seemed to like it. Eventually, I started doing characters for them. My friend Don and I had an act where we were Roger and Ethel Spielonger, a married nerd couple. As Roger, I wore glasses, a bow tie, and a pocket protector. Roger snorted whenever he laughed. Mostly, we just performed for our friends. We'd announce that Roger and Ethel were going to make an appearance. They'd gather around and we'd come out in our accessories, put on a show, and everyone would laugh. At the weekly school assembly, we'd stand up as Roger and Ethel and announce what was going on that week in the drama department. It became kind of a cult thing at the school, where Roger and Ethel would be brought in to lead various events. Finally, I wasn't just a girl with a famous father. Meanwhile, I was trying to be a real actress outside of school. I'd been taking private acting lessons since I was 8, and after a couple of years, my coach decided I was ready to start auditioning. I may have been young, but I knew that acting exclusively in my father's shows didn't really count. So I got an agent and a manager. Then, when I was around 11, the guy who'd been my manager for a year dropped me. According to my mother, he said, I wasn't hungry enough. I always reflect on that comment. It was one of those defining moments that pushed me to take acting even more seriously. Being told I can't do something always makes me want to succeed. I'd show him. I still fantasize that if I ever win an award for something, he'd be one of the many people I'd thank for telling me I couldn't do it. At home, I started to voice my opinions about my famous father's work. My dad was beginning to see me as more of an individual, a person with valid thoughts and ideas. I'd always been interested in casting. Even at the age of 5, when I'd see a movie with a child actor I thought was good, I'd run out of the room to fetch pen and paper. When the credits rolled, I'd write down her name and hand it to my dad, saying, "You should hire her." My father always paid close attention to my suggestions for edits and casting and took them seriously. In fact, Emma Sams is always saying she owes her career to me. I'd seen her as Holly on General Hospital and recommended her to my father for Fallon on Dynasty, a lead role she had for 5 years. It's not like my dad took advice from everyone. We'd be talking about a scene, my mother would start to interject, and he'd cut her off, saying, "Candy, please." Needless to say, this sort of behavior wasn't great for my relationship with my mom. But more on that later. Eventually, all the auditioning I was doing paid off. I did a movie with Shelley Long called Troop Beverly Hills, had a guest appearance on a show called The Wizard, and I appeared on the sitcom Saved by the Bell. When I auditioned for the part of Violet Bickerstaff on Saved by the Bell, I pretty much did my Roger Spielonger character, snorting when I laughed, and got the part. The producers of Saved by the Bell were happy enough with my performance that they kept bringing back my character. I even had my first kiss on that show. It was with Screech. It's true. My first kiss wasn't with the cool surfer chef, 11 years my senior. It was with Screech, the biggest dork on national television. My dad had nothing to do with any of these jobs, and I was really proud of that. I know, Saved by the Bell isn't Citizen Kane, but it was a well-earned paycheck. Then I made an interesting discovery while rooting through my father's briefcase. I'd like to read his scripts and make casting suggestions, but this time I picked up a script for a pilot, the first episode of a TV show called Class of Beverly Hills. As I started reading it, I realized that every single part called for someone my age. I was blown away. It was the first script I'd ever seen of his that had all teenage characters. At the time, there weren't any hour-long dramas that had an all-teenage cast. I didn't really want to ask my father for a part. I was doing pretty well on my own. But I called my agent and told her about it. She said, "Do you want me to get you an audition?" I told her that I was embarrassed to go in as the boss's daughter. If I got the part, I wanted it to be because I deserved it. I said, "Can't you just tell them a fake name?" No question, she was going to drop my father's name. But she humored me. Next thing I knew, I had an audition set up with the director and casting director. There's not a shot in hell they didn't know it was me. I read for the part of a character called Kelly in Class of Beverly Hills. I didn't get Kelly, but they offered me the consolation part of Donna, a small character who had all of 3 lines in the pilot. Clearly, my dad had said, just give my daughter some small role. But I was happy to accept any part. Eventually, it was all over the press that I'd auditioned for the role with a fake name, but that everyone had known it was me. How exactly did that story get out? Oh, my father thought it was so cute that he told it all over town. And why did he have so many opportunities to tell it? Because Class of Beverly Hills, which was renamed Beverly Hills 90210, would become a hit. They hated me at Hello. We shot the pilot for Beverly Hills 90210 when I was in 10th grade. By the time 11th grade started, the show was up and running. On the first day of work, I arrived at the set an hour early, parked a block away, and sat there waiting for an hour in my car until the time I was scheduled to show up on set. The cast and crew knew I was the producer's daughter. Undoubtedly, they assumed that's why I had the job, and they weren't wrong. I had everything to prove. I was terrified, but I was used to being scared. Maybe it was growing up with the Madame Alexander dolls. Regardless, I was there early the first day. I planned to be early every day thereafter, and I was determined to say every line perfectly so nobody could find anything bad to say about me. I didn't expect they'd pay much attention to me anyway. I was just a bit player. I was intrigued by my co-stars, but for a long time I was too shy to be myself around them. I had an insta-crush on Brian Austin Green, and there was always a little spark between us through all the years of the show. More on that later. I thought Jenny Garth and Shannon Doherty seemed cool, but I barely spoke to them until a week into shooting the pilot, when we were almost done. There was a party scene with me, Jenny, who played Kelly, Shannon, who played Brenda, and a guest cast girl. The shoot went late, until midnight, and I started acting goofy and self-deprecating. Jenny said, "You're funny. You seemed so shy." It doesn't seem like much, but that was a turning point. From then on, Shannon, Jenny, and I were friends. Ian Ziering, Steve, and Jason Priestley, Brandon, somehow seemed much older than I was, and we really only became friends years later. And as for Luke Perry, Dylan, when I first started, he was just the cool, inaccessible older guy. He was always flirtatious. He called me Camel because he said I had long eyelashes like a camel. Trust me, Luke Perry can call you Camel and make it sound sexy. When you were with him, he made you feel like you were the only other person in the world. But either because he was a guy or because of the age difference, it was tough for me to have a true heart-to-heart with him. Only later would I realize what a loyal friend he really was. When the show first started, I had a really small part. Donna had about 2 lines per episode, and those lines were mostly complex dramatic encounters wherein I had to say something as deep and meaningful as, "Hi, Brenda," or "See you later, Kelly." Sort of the 16-year-old version of, "Hi, Uncle Dan." Thank God for all those acting lessons. So few lines, and yet in response to my delivery of them, the press had a field day. Maybe I should have known they'd target me because of my father, but it was my first real taste of negative press, and it was brutal. I couldn't act, and I was unattractive to boot. At first, I was hurt, then a little annoyed. I mean, hi, Brenda. How could they possibly hear me say 2 words and conclude that I was a lousy actress? Seriously. Anyone who could speak could do the lines I was doing. They were against me because of who I was. They hated me at Hello. My dad advised me to stop reading the tabloids, but it was easier said than done. I was young and the criticism felt very public, but it also motivated me. Having so few lines meant I had lots of time to think about what I could do to grow my part. 90210 was a drama, but I'd always been more of a clown, so I tried to find ways to stand out in the crowd. When Donna was in a group, I'd give her a funny reaction, rolling my eyes or grimacing or pursing my lips. The writers and producers noticed that I was something of a ham. They asked if I liked comedy, and when I said I did, it gave them a direction for Donna. They decided to make her ditzy, giving her plenty of physical comedy stuff. Stuff like Donna on Halloween. Everyone is going to a costume party, and Donna's dressed like a mermaid and can't walk. Or Donna at the school formal. She comes in a Gone with the Wind dress and can't get out of the limo. All this was old hat to me. My Marie Antoinette costume and the other Halloween get-ups of my youth had given me plenty of practice with wardrobe-inflicted catastrophes. Little by little, Donna became a bigger part of the show. Donna's character grew because I worked on her. The truth about my father was that he was perfectly content with me having a token role with two lines an episode. In fact, I was lowballed money-wise because he was embarrassed about the nepotism. Even during the second year on the show, when I was one of the leads, I still got paid the Screen Actors Guild minimum for a series regular, far below the escalating salaries of my co-stars. 90210 wasn't an instant hit, but during the second season, just as I was graduating from high school and getting more mileage as Donna, it started to take off. Not only was the show doing well, but it seemed like as soon as I finished high school, the cast started accepting me. I could tell because they'd talk about my dad as a producer in front of me without being afraid that I'd go tattle. They were comfortable and knew we were all in it together. Oh, but of course, it wasn't always that simple. I was on 90210 for 10 years, from when I was 16 to when I was 26. So for better and for worse, I grew up on the show. It kind of sucked that I didn't get to go to college. My life was on the set. All my flirtations and friendships were on the job. There I was, trying to grow my character, develop as an actor, and generally conduct myself in a professional manner. And at the same time, I was completely caught up in the drama of who was flirting with whom and who was sleeping with whom. And there was plenty of drama. In fact, sometimes instead of going to college, it felt as if I was reliving high school. And not just because of the topic of the show. The whole cast was young. Brian Greene, who played David, my on-screen, on-again, off-again, on-again boyfriend, and I were the youngest cast members. Jenny was a year older than we were, Shannon 3 years older, Jason 4 years older, Luke and Ian 10 years older, and Gabrielle Carteris, who played Andrea, was 12 years older. For a while, these people were my whole social world. When someone knocked on my dressing room door, there was always a flutter of, who's it going to be, Luke Perry or Brian Greene? Or Jason would pop into my dressing room to say hi, and I'd be psyched. The split center of this high school clique was definitely Shannon and Jenny. The press about Shannon was harsh. She'd been famous since she was young, starring in Little House on the Prairie, Our House, and the movie Heathers. Shannon had everything, but she could be arrogant and carefree. Meanwhile, Jenny worked really hard. She started at the bottom and appreciated what she had. And Jenny was outspoken when she thought Shannon was out of line. Shannon didn't appreciate that. She liked to be in control. Sometimes they got along, but there were explosions. Once, walking back to their cars, they actually almost got into a fistfight. Ian and Brian had to break it up. I always felt like I was in the middle. If I wanted to have lunch with Jenny, I'd sneak into her dressing room so Shannon didn't come looking for me. And there were times Shannon would say, let's ignore Jenny. When she talks to us, pretend you don't hear her. Then other days, Shannon would say, let's do something nice. Let's go out for drinks and invite Jenny. When Shannon reached out, Jenny always responded. Who wants that kind of friction? But Shannon, for no apparent reason, might change her tune again the next day. It was all so unnecessary. Shannon took me under her wing, and because I didn't know any better, I gratefully accepted my new perch. A night with Shannon meant going to the hottest club and drinking until the early hours. I knew she was a bad influence, but I liked her anyway. I heard later that Shannon used me to get her way on set. If wardrobe gave her a dress she didn't want to wear, she'd say, Tori says it doesn't look good, and she's going to tell her dad if you don't change it. The producers, wardrobe, makeup, and hair people believed her. Only later, when they knew me better, did they realize that I didn't pull that stuff. I didn't go all diva for myself, so why in the world would I do it for her? There were different cliques at different times, but for the most part, the cast and crew functioned as a close, hardworking family. In the course of the 10 years the show was on the air, everyone in the cast pretty much slept with everyone else, and no serious relationships ever developed. We all would laugh about